This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. If you could ask Miami about the choices that they've made, they might contend the best of them was picking up Dwayne Wade. Despite having to leave last night's game against New Jersey temporarily with an elbow injury, Wade ended up scoring 30 points and contributing 10 assists as the Heat beat the Nets 103-92 to assume a 2-1 lead in their playoff series. Elsewhere in the NBA postseason action, Phoenix slipped by the Los Angeles Clippers 94-91. The Suns lead that series 2-1. Today, the third game in the Basketball Battle of Texas, or the I-35 series, if you prefer, will take place when the three-time NBA champion San Antonio Spurs will be hosted by the zero-time NBA champion Dallas Mavericks. Joining me now on the line is Art Garcia, who covers the Mavericks for the Fort Worth Star-Telegram. Art, welcome to Only a Game.
Oh, thanks. My pleasure.
Aside from geography, what determines who roots for the Mavs and who pulls for the Spurs?
Well, I think probably geography is a big key in that. But, you know, it's funny that the Mavericks have been sort of an NBA joke for a long time. The 90s, I think they were the worst team in professional sports. A lot of fans, you know, jumped off the bandwagon for that decade. And, you know, frankly, they struggled around here, just kind of generating interest and getting people to come out to games. And with Mark Cuban buying the team 6 years ago now, which to me is nuts that it's been so long, there's been sort of this rejuvenation in the area and fans, you know, Mark's brought a lot of energy, you know, fans have come back, and it's actually been quite a happening scene in Dallas. And San Antonio's been good for so long that they have their hardcore fans, you know, all over the state, frankly. I mean, they have fans in Houston and San Antonio, and obviously up here. But the Mavs have won a lot of those people back, and I think it's made for a really fun rivalry and a really good sort of a series between these two teams.
The Mavericks have always had the reputation as a fine offensive team, at least since they've started being a successful team. But this year, many have cited their defense as a key reason for that success. How has the team made the transformation?
The biggest key has been their head coach. Avery Johnson is a disciple of defense. He played so long in San Antonio for Greg Popovich, who, you know, has built sort of a defensive power down there. And Avery's taken a lot of those principles and applied it to the Mavericks. And he's a guy, he was 5'11", he was undersized, but he managed to play 16 years in the league. And you don't do that without having a lot of heart, a lot of determination, a lot of grit. And those are qualities that, you know, translate easily to defense. And I think he's brought that to this team. You know, they've kept a lot of their offensive identity. They still score. This team was very successful under their former coach, Don Nelson. Avery has kept that component there, but sort of infused this defensive energy, this defensive focus. And, you know, that's why this team is probably better equipped than it's ever been to make a run at a championship, to make a run deep into the playoffs. You know, I think that all gets back to Avery Johnson. His personality is really this team now. And I think that's, you know, a credit to him.
Mark Cuban, the owner of the Mavericks, was hit with a $200,000 fine after he went onto the court following Game 1 of the series and then criticized NBA officials in his web blog. The Mavericks Owners Act has worn thin with the league. How do fans feel about the way Mark Cuban behaves himself?
Well, I think in opposing cities, Mark is a great target for fans. You know, he's the kind of guy that plays up to the fans, and, you know, they start chanting things that, you know, we can't repeat on the radio. But Mark usually enjoys that kind of banter and, you know, usually gets pretty spirited, so that's fun to watch. And at home, I think they just love him because, you know, what you have is the ultimate fan owning the team. And in so many instances, you know, these billionaires get involved in sports from an investment standpoint. Mark freely admits that he probably loses $25 to $30 million a year on this team, but it doesn't seem to faze him. I mean, he's been a sports nut his whole life. Here's a guy that when he first moved to Dallas, I mean, was buying tickets upstairs, you know, $5 tickets just to get into games and watch basketball. As he started making money, you know, those tickets got closer and closer to the front row. And then with the internet boom and the billions that he made, you know, he said, you know, what the heck, I'm going to buy a team. I mean, he's not an owner that is, you know, definitely in the background. He's a fan. He's a guy that's going to be up front and cheer for his team. He's going to yell at referees. So, you know, in this area, people love him. And I can see why outside of this area they don't. But either way, for me, it's fun to cover.
If he really does lose $25 to $30 million a season, how much would the NBA have to fine him in order to have him notice?
These fines, yeah, I think you'd probably have to be talking about multi-million dollar fines, because he just basically blows these things off. I mean, from the beginning, every time he's been fined, he's matched the amount to charity. He's picked a different charity. And yeah, these things, I think, are more of an annoyance, and the NBA is looking at it from a PR standpoint. Obviously, the money doesn't hurt.
The Dallas-San Antonio series is currently tied at one game apiece. The Mavericks have lost twice before to the Spurs in the playoffs, 2001 and 2003. Does that work to San Antonio's advantage this time around?
I don't think as much, because there's only one or two players left that played in those series. Dirk Nowitzki's pretty much the only guy left. They have a new coach. Avery was here before, but he was here as a player. I don't think there's really a psychological edge from that standpoint. I think both these teams know that the other is a really good team. It's going to be a hard-fought series. You know, at this point, I don't think history really makes a difference.
Well, we've come to prediction time, so tell me how far you think the Dallas Mavericks will go in the 2006 postseason.
Well, I picked before the series that they'd beat San Antonio. You know, I believe these are the two best teams in the Western Conference, so even though this is the second round, I look at this as the Western Conference final, and whichever team gets out of this round, I think, goes to the NBA Finals. And so I think this team is probably going to end up battling Detroit for the NBA title, and I know in this area that's going to be something that people are really going to look forward to.
Art Garcia covers the Dallas Mavericks for the Fort Worth Star-Telegram. He joined me on the line from Fort Worth. Art, thank you very much.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
For nearly a decade, when the New York Yankees and the Boston Red Sox haven't finished 1-2 in the American League's Eastern Division, they've finished 2-1. In the early going this spring, that pattern seems to be holding. The two teams are tied for first place. But just two games beneath the battling titans of the AL East lurk the pesky Blue Jays. Actually, pesky is perhaps less appropriate in this context than muscle-bound. Collectively, Toronto's outfielders have been hitting about 80 points above their career averages. Before a game against the Red Sox last week at Fenway Park, one of those outfielders, Reed Johnson, acknowledged that the club probably couldn't count on that sort of hitting throughout the summer.
I think you look at the numbers now and you see some 380s and, you know, up in the 400 area. I mean, obviously, you know, reality, we all know that, you know, the numbers are going to drop from there. But, you know, we're going to ride this thing as long as we can. And but I think that if you do look at the group of outfielders that we do have, we're the type of guys that go into an off season and, you know, recognize what we did poorly the year before, and we're able to get better as hitters every year. And, you know, I think that's huge as far as your development as a ball player goes, is to try to get better every year.
For the past half dozen years and more, the Yankees and Red Sox have remained enough better than the Blue Jays to keep Toronto out of the playoffs. According to Reed Johnson, this year's Jays hope to make recent history work to their advantage.
For us, we're happy right now that it is still all the talk about Yankees, Red Sox, and we're just trying to take one series at a time and, you know, take a 2 out of 3 or a 3 out of 4 or whatever series we're looking at. And, you know, I think if we do that over a long period of time, that we're going to be able to have success. And we like it the way it is right now, because everybody still is talking about the Yankees and the Red Sox, and we're kind of laying low still, and, you know, hopefully we can sneak up on them in August and September.
That a current Jay should have to talk about sneaking up on the Red Sox and Yankees is not surprising. While Toronto is not a big market team, New York consistently has the highest payroll in the major leagues, and Boston is never far behind, a circumstance of which Blue Jays coach and former catcher Ernie Witt is well aware.
Well, it's hard to not be aware of it, because of the fact that they have the resources, they put together a good team, and that's just the reality of it, is that they've been there. And so we've had a little spike in our payroll, and hopefully we've put some pieces of the puzzle together that will, you know, afford us a chance to compete with these guys.
The little spike to which Witt refers bumped the Jays' payroll up about $28 million for the 2006 season and enabled Toronto to acquire closer B.J. Ryan, catcher Benji Molina, and infielder Troy Gloss, among others. Still, New York's payroll this season is $195 million. Boston's is $120 million. Even the beefed-up Jays' tab is only $72 million. Lyle Overbay, who came to the Jays from the Brewers over the winter, shrugs off the monetary gap between his new club and the two monsters ahead of the Jays in the AL East, contending that he and his teammates relish the challenge of competing against their more wealthy opponents.
Absolutely. I mean, these are the teams to beat, and it's fun to be able to go out every day and compete with these guys. I mean, if you're going to be the best, you got to beat the best, and those guys have proven to be on top, and it's fun to get out here and play against them.
An attitude like that can't hurt, but Ernie Witt, whose playing career included 12 seasons in Toronto and two postseason appearances with the Jays, maintains that the key isn't money spent, but value acquired for that money. He thinks Jays management did a fine job of preparing the 06 team to compete.
Well, number one, I think having a closer. I know BJ only closed last year, was his first year doing it, but he was very effective doing it. And so far this year, he's been very effective for us. And to me, you win championships on pitching and defense, and we've been able to catch the ball. Our pitching has not been like it. I thought that it would be. Actually, our offense has been carrying us, which we really didn't expect. So it'd be nice to put them both together, pitching and defense and offense, and then we'll see what happens.
Wednesday night's game against Oakland provided a snapshot version of the bigger picture Ernie Witt hopes will continue to develop. The Jays got four hits from Reed Johnson, who raised his batting average to .389, and a grand slam from Lyle Overbay. They needed all that offense, having blown a 6-run lead, and ended up winning the slugfest 9-7 thanks to an inning and a third of scoreless relief from aforementioned closer B.J. Ryan. Tonight, the Blue Jays, looking to loom ever larger in the rearview mirrors of the Red Sox and the Yankees, will play the Devil Rays in Tampa Bay. You can take a closer listen to this week's stories, find a link to our weekly podcasts, peruse our archives, or sign up for our newsletter by visiting our website at onlyagame.org. It's 19 minutes past the hour. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, the story of boxer Gabriel Sandoval, a.k.a. Jesus El Matador Chavez. But first, today at the University of Louisville, Illinois meets Louisville in the regional semifinals of the NCAA Division I Men's Tennis Championship. Tournament director and Louisville assistant AD Dr. Holly Sheely is thrilled by the NCAA's choice of venue.
Every opportunity we have to host the NCAA championship, we do. So we feel honored to be able to do it, and we like to showcase our campus and our athletes and our facilities.
There was some surprise in the NCAA's choice. Louisville was ranked 27th going into this weekend's tournament. The region's top seed, Illinois, at number 8, had hosted the first and second rounds of the tournament for the previous 7 years, and Dr. Sheely said would have been the more likely choice to host this weekend's tournament.
It's going to be dependent upon rankings. So if someone who's ranked higher than you also puts in a bid and they've held previous NCAA championships and have done a good job, they're going to get it over you. So even though I think we're an excellent site, if Illinois had submitted a bid, which they did, and had not had the issue with mascot, they probably would have got it because they do host championships at their place.
The mascot problem to which Dr. Sheely alludes is Chief Alinowick, a student dressed in buckskins who's danced at halftime in Urbana-Champaign for the past 80 years. Late last month, the NCAA denied the University of Illinois' second appeal and declared the school ineligible to host postseason tournaments due to the use of, quote, hostile and abusive imagery. Joining me now on the line is John Supini, who covers all things Illini for the Copley News Service. John, welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you very much.
The NCAA has exempted a number of schools, including the Florida State Seminoles, from their ban. The University of Illinois won the right to continue calling its sports teams the Illini and the Fighting Illini earlier this year. Had the school expected that they would win this appeal as well?
I don't think so. They were fighting it, but I don't think they really expected to win. I think it was a losing battle the whole time. I mean, it's hard to win sometimes against the NCAA.
Despite a terrific season, the men's tennis team packed their bags for Louisville earlier this week. How were the players and coaches feeling about losing the home court advantage?
they were frustrated. They felt that their body of work during the season was strong enough to earn a home bid for the NCAA tournament, which every team likes to play at home. Everybody loves the home court advantage, and they felt that they had enough credentials on the court to do that. But they also understood earlier this month that when Illinois lost the appeal, that immediately meant it fell right into the lap of the men's tennis team, which is 3 years ago they won the NCAA National Championship, and it's a very strong program, and they're very proud of what they do over there at the tennis courts, and they really wanted to host the meet, but the athletes in sports other than football and basketball, this is all falling in their lap. This is something that's directly affecting them, and it's doing it now immediately. Those athletes are, while everybody at the University of Illinois or most of the people have a devotion toward the chief, right now some of the athletes are a little nervous about saying too much against the chief, even if it does affect them, which it's starting to now.
The NCAA ban affects all sports, of course, as you mentioned, but since the football and basketball postseasons are held at neutral sites, this ruling really does affect the non-revenue sports the most. Even though the sports are referred to as non-revenue, the school still has plenty to lose by not hosting postseason tournaments, right?
Oh, yes. When you look at it from the athletic director's point of view, here he's spending millions of dollars on facilities, on scholarships, on coaches' salaries of all these other sports. And then at the present time, he's asking these players and coaches to play on an unlevel playing field, whereas some people compete and try to build a resume to where you can host events and give yourself a better chance in the NCAA tournaments. Illinois can't do that right now. So, you know, at this point, from a player and coach's point of view, that's unfair.
What other sports besides tennis are likely to feel the pinch of this ruling?
This fall, the women's soccer program is pretty good here at Illinois, and they've hosted events in the past. The women's volleyball team is fairly strong. It's hosted events in the past, and that's who would see it right off the bat.
My understanding is that, in fact, the chief doesn't appear for tennis matches or volleyball matches or maybe even women's soccer games. It's pretty much a basketball and football guy, right?
Yes, the chief, Chief Alanowick, only makes appearances at home men's basketball and women's basketball and football games. That's the only sports where he appears. So these sports that are directly affected, the chief does not appear there. So it's pretty ironic.
Given the disadvantages, what are the university's options at this point?
Well, you know, the university has basically three options. It can go along with the NCAA ruling and retire Chief Alanowick. It can say, well, we will keep Chief Alanowick and we will deal with the NCAA punishment and just not host championship events, or they can try some litigation. But that can run up a very big bill pretty quickly.
I just hesitate to think of what litigation based on this would sound like and look like. I mean, wouldn't it leave everybody feeling kind of silly?
Yeah, I think so. I think the Illinois point of view on that would be that the university should be able to decide its course of action on the chief rather than the NCAA. I think that's what they would try to point out. They would also probably try to say, how can you have a mascot or a symbol at Florida State when you don't allow it here? Mm-hmm. You know, they would try to make comparisons there, too.
The university has not yet made an official statement on its plans, but have you gotten a sense of which direction they'll go?
I think a lot of people expect them to retire the chief. It's hard to describe the amount of devotion and just, I mean, blind love that college graduates of this university and sports fans have of the chief. I mean, they love, honor, and respect this mascot or symbol or whatever, however you want to describe him, and it's very tough to give it up. But I think the administration and the university and the athletic department is going to have to do that to have a level playing field for everybody else in athletics. And the only time the chief appears is at athletic events. So the athletic department is the one that's directly affected, and I think it's going to have to go that way.
John Supini covers Illini sports for the Copley News Service. John, thank you very much for joining me.
Well, I hope I helped today.
By the time he was 16 years old, Gabriel Sandoval was an accomplished amateur boxer. A year later, he was convicted of armed robbery and sent to jail. Before he began serving a sentence that turned out to be for 4 years, he told his father, "When I get out of this place, I'm going to be the champion of the world." Standing Eight tells the story of Gabriel Sandoval's attempt to fulfill that unlikely promise. Joining me now from the studios of KUT in Austin, Texas, is Standing Eight author Adam Pitluck. Adam, welcome to Only a Game.
Thank you very much.
And Gabriel Sandoval, a.k.a. Jesus El Matador Chavez, about whom Standing Eight was written. Jesus, welcome to the program.
Glad to be on board.
Adam, how did you first learn about, well, at that point, Gabriel's story?
When I first came on the scene with this story, I was a cub reporter for a street weekly in Dallas. And a lady came into the paper one day and asked to speak with the youngest reporter on staff who would also be a sports fan. And that, as fate would have it, would be me. So when she told me this story, Gabriel was already in exile in Mexico. And I pitched the story to my editor, the story of this top-ranked boxer, number one-ranked fighter in the world in the super featherweight class, according to the WBC. And I was on a plane to Mexico the next week to meet up with him in Delicias. That was in 2000, and I stuck with the story ever since.
Jesus, I want to take the story back a little bit to the point where you were released from prison in Illinois, barely out of your teens. You were deported to Mexico. Were you surprised when you learned that that was going to happen?
Yeah, a little bit. I'd gone through immigration court while incarcerated, so I knew that I was going to get deported, but not that soon after being released. I thought initially I was hoping that it wasn't some big April Fool's Day joke that I was getting out of jail and getting deported, and they were serious.
And how did you re-enter the U.S.?
I re-entered the U.S. about maybe 2 weeks after being deported to Mexico City. I may add that when I got deported to Mexico City, I had $50 in my pocket and didn't know the country of Mexico at all. So I entered the country about a week and a half, 2 weeks after that. And I pretty much went undetected and found my way back to Chicago.
You weren't in Chicago for long, in part because the temptation to rejoin the gang that you had run with there was pretty strong, and also because your father thought that you'd be better off elsewhere. The elsewhere turned out to be Texas, but when you applied for a driver's license there with a fake Social Security card, you got caught and deported again. Adam, this is where you come back into the picture, because this is when you met up with him in Mexico. How promising was his boxing career then in 2000?
It was a very strange dichotomy of events. His boxing career would have been peaking. He was the number one ranked boxer in the world for a shot at Floyd Mayweather's WBC belt. The problem was, down in Mexico, there was nothing to contend for. Boxing promoters were not quick to schedule any such prize fights in countries other than the U.S. or perhaps Europe because of the strength of the dollar. So he was essentially just squandering his time down there. He had to train himself, which while other boxers in the U.S. were at either top-flight gyms or were now accustomed to a professional training regimen, Jesus was dragging himself up a mountain 5 days a week. Literally starting at Cox Crow and getting up there before the heat became too intense. Then he'd run back down. And when he needed to spar, when he needed to hit the bags, he went to the city's lone gym, which was actually the Gimnasio Municipal. It was the city's basketball court. And underneath the home team's bleachers, there were a couple heavy bags. And that's where he would train himself.
Thus began an effort to get Jesus back into the U.S. legally. How did that finally happen?
Well, I have a big support group here in Austin, Texas, that orchestrated a support team for Jesus Chavez, or Gabriel Sandoval, as they would prefer to call me. Richard Garriott and the Garriott family, Marcy and Robert, they hired Barbara Hines, who is an immigration attorney. Barbara went and figured out that I was eligible to ask for a pardon from the INS, and once that got granted, I was able to get back into the country legally as a resident alien.
I'm curious about how both of you feel about the current discussion regarding how the U.S. should handle immigrants, illegal immigrants, given what you have been through, Gabriel, and what you have witnessed, Adam.
This story in particular has made me do a 180 on my own thoughts of immigration and of U.S. policy. And it's ironic that the book came out now when this is the hot-button issue on the front pages of national newspapers and on talk shows. Were it not for Ronald Reagan's amnesty in 86, the Sandoval family would not be here. Sandoval family have proved that they were a very hardworking family, very loving, very devout, and in the end, both very Mexican and very American. And that's indicative of the 21st century American tapestry. This is not just a black and white or a brown issue. This is very much interwoven into our own fabric now.
One other thing, I think that it has become important. This story has all of those struggles, all of the qualities of people who are trying to come into this country and be productive. I have, and my family have been those people who have swam across the river and found their way in American society. And through all the struggles and with my personal struggles, trying to keep myself alive and come above and finally become champion of the world, it gives me a lot of satisfaction to know that most of the Mexican people who are coming into this country are here to participate, to give, to pay taxes, and to be honorable members of society.
The highlights of your boxing career seem clear enough. You won a super featherweight championship in 1997 and then the lightweight title in 2005. But after that latter fight, your opponent, Levander Johnson, died of the injuries that he had sustained during the bout. How did that affect you?
That was a very hard moment in my life. I felt in the beginning, I felt very guilty. I thought that Levander had passed a better time because of the punches that I'd given him. And, that was a very hard time for me to get over because even during this time, my wife was serving in Iraq. I was very fortunate to have Levander Johnson's family. I called them up before the funeral and asked if I could come up there and be there with them. And I think that they're just the most wonderful people there are because aside from trying to get professional help, I think that overwhelmingly even better was how Levander Johnson's family treated me when I went up to New Jersey. And they told me that I needed to keep fighting. And every time I fought, that I should have Levander Johnson's spirit and the Johnson's blessings to continue doing what I was doing. And unfortunately, after that, I was training leading up for a big fight against Marco Antonio Barrera, where I would be defending my 135-pound IBF lightweight championship. And I blew my shoulder for the second time. And so now I am out on medical leave. I look forward to fighting hopefully by the end of the year and continue with my career. And that will be my first title defense of the lightweight championship. Certainly looking forward to defend that with honors and keep Levander in my heart.
Adam Pitluck is the author of Standing Eight, subtitled The Inspiring Story of Jesus El Matador Chavez, who became the lightweight champion of the world. He joined me from KUT in Austin, Texas. The book is published by DeCapo Press. Adam, thank you very much for speaking with me.
It's been a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
And we've also been joined by Gabriel Sandoval, a.k.a. Jesus El Matador Chavez. Gabriel, thank you very much.
Thank you, and I appreciate you calling me Gabriel.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, by the Dairy Farm families who own Cabot Creamery, five generations of farming and making naturally aged cheddar cheese in Vermont, on the web at cabotcheese.com, and Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting, available at the Implant Dentistry Center at bicon.com, bicon.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, skydiving instruction for people unwilling to skydive. But first, Charlie Pierce joins me by telephone from Dublin, Ireland. Doubtless I'm interrupting a golf game, for which I'm sorry, but grateful. Charlie, thank you for being there.
I did bring my dental record, so in case I was found lost in a pot bunker, they could identify me.
Oh, that's good. Very wise. On Thursday, Floyd Patterson died, Charlie. In 1960, he became the first boxer to regain the heavyweight championship. And against the advice of John F. Kennedy, among others, he gave Sonny Liston an opportunity to fight for that title. For what else should Floyd Patterson be remembered?
He is a fascinating footnote between the old fighters and the enormous event that was Muhammad Ali. He'll be remembered among boxing aficionados for the two fights with Ingemar Johansson, for losing as badly as he did to Liston, and for the positively cruel way that Muhammad Ali tormented him when they finally fought. He was a man of some dignity, some odd quirks for a fighter, and as I said, he was present at the creation of an awful lot.
The Detroit Pistons enjoy a 2-0 series lead over the Cleveland Cavaliers in the second round of the NBA playoffs. Will Cleveland make a series of it, starting with today's Game 3 at home?
I think they'll give a good account of themselves for the home folks in Games 3 and Game 5, but I think you're seeing the difference now between LeBron, where LeBron James is and where he wants to get. The Pistons are just very, very good, and their strengths correspond so perfectly to the Cleveland weaknesses that I don't think, you know, besides a couple of shows for the home folks by LeBron, you're going to see much of a series here.
On Wednesday, New Orleans / Oklahoma City Hornets owner George Shin said that the team will return to New Orleans for the 2007-2008 NBA season, and then the following day, Mr. Shin's lawyer said the team would relocate if New Orleans can't get a new practice facility built right next to the New Orleans arena. What's going on here?
Well, there is no bigger porker in professional sports than George Shin. I mean, his very presence is a blight on everything he touches. He's holding up a drowned and wounded city and a drowned and wounded state for ransom, and he's using Oklahoma City to do it. And Oklahoma City apparently is quite willing to let him.
Well, Oklahoma City released the results of a new study this week, which concluded that the presence of the Hornets in that city had an economic impact of over $66 million. George Shin says it's more like $150 million. Where'd he come up with that figure?
From that place from which most sports owners pull their figures. No, I don't believe the $66 million either. So I think that's a crock of beans. So I think if $66 million is a crock of beans, $150 million is a very large crock of beans.
Just last week, you opined that Colorado just might take the 2006 Stanley Cup, but oops, the Avalanche fell in four straight to the apparently mighty Ducks of Anaheim. What happened there?
Hey, first of all, what happens west of the Atlantic does not get spoken of east of the Atlantic, number one. Number two, I think I was probably wrong.
Elsewhere in the second round of the NHL postseason, the Buffalo Sabres are up 3-1 over the favored Ottawa Senators, and Carolina is beating up on the heretofore red-hot Devils of New Jersey. More evidence that we're living in a topsy-turvy world of hockey.
More evidence that coming out of the lockout, at least the top-level teams have really established some parity among themselves. The Carolina result startles me because New Jersey was playing so very well.
On Saturday, Charlie, Ricardo Mayorga lost his WBC welterweight title fight to Oscar De La Hoya. He was notified on Wednesday that he could be fined because he had tested positive for the diuretic Lasix. So at least he gets to run in the Preakness next Saturday, right?
May I just say on behalf of Ricardo.
And then how many times did you take it, Ricardo?
Exactly right. He is a crazy person, by the way. He's the one who claims he trains on Budweiser and cigarettes. Apparently there's a little bit more to it than that.
When Jeff Boris, Barry Bonds' agent, told the press that he had every reason to believe that his client, Mr. Bonds, would play in 2007 and that he might hit 1,000 home runs, Bonds said, maybe he knows something I don't know. Do you think Mr. Boris has watched Bonds play in the outfield lately?
The unkind answer to this would be perhaps he's spoken to the pharmacist and Barry hasn't. But I don't think he's going to hit 1,000 home runs. I don't think he's going to hit 756 and go past Henry Aaron.
Baseball fan Michael Cohn has filed a sex and age discrimination suit against the Los Angeles Angels of Anaheim because he says the team's failure to give him and other male fans a red nylon tote bag during a 2005 Mother's Day promotion constitutes unequal treatment. What is your legal opinion on this one, Justice Pierce?
This is one of those silly reverse discrimination things, so everybody can have a little bit of whoop-de-doo about how the women are taking over the world. This is an embarrassment to the legal process.
And finally, Charlie, yesterday in Spain, tennis star Maria Sharapova handpicked 7 male models out of 15 candidates to determine which would serve as ball boys in the Madrid Masters tournament in November. She interviewed each before making her choices. What do you suppose she asked them?
I think she asked them if they'd all love a lovely red nylon tote bag from the California Angels of Anaheim.
Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine, and his new book, Moving the Chains, Tom Brady and the Pursuit of Everything, published by Farrar, Straus, and Giroux, will be available in the fall. He joins me each week at this time on Only a Game. Thanks, Charlie.
Bill, you didn't ask me about anything I watched. I watched all the French rugby highlights
next
last
week,
night. Not a question.
Next week, ladies and gentlemen, French rugby highlights.
Thanks, Bill.
I gotta get running now.
Bellboy.
Keep my lip buttoned down.
Bellboy.
Carry this baggage out.
Bellboy.
Always running at someone's bleeding in.
Have you ever been tempted to step out of an airplane door and hurtle toward the earth at speeds upward of 130 miles per hour? Neither have I. But for those who would like to experience body flight without jumping from an airplane, instructors are standing by at 6 indoor skydiving centers across the United States, and this summer, a 7th center will open in Nashua, New Hampshire. Earlier this year, Only a Game's Karen Given visited the country's oldest indoor skydiving center in Las Vegas, and she has this report.
Flyaway Indoor Skydiving occupies a former bank in a nondescript shopping center less than 2 blocks from the glitz and glamour of the Las Vegas Strip. From the outside, the place is rather unimposing. That is, until you notice the octagonal structure tacked onto the north side. It's that part of the building, the wind tunnel, that has me standing on the curb for a few minutes, trying to find the nerve to go in. Once inside, the center has the laid-back vibe of a Southern California surf shop. On this quiet Wednesday morning, instructors lounge around the front desk, swapping stories and hanging out, led by manager Dave McMahon.
What's happening?
Not much. It looks kind of scary from out there.
Oh, it's too much fun. It should be illegal. All right. You're flying, right?
Yeah.
Fantastic. Name, age, height, and weight.
Okay.
Dave gives me a quick form to fill out before I'm to be whisked upstairs for my 20-minute training session with an instructor named Josh. Since arriving in Las Vegas a few days ago, I've only mentioned my appointment at Flyaway to 2 people. The first told me I'd be safer jumping out of a real airplane. The second insisted there are so many injuries at Flyaway, local ambulance drivers have been instructed to turn off their sirens when entering the neighborhood. It's that second rumor that Dave finds most intriguing.
The ambulance thing, it's hilarious because we actually, Kevin, one of our instructors, he actually was like trying to become a paramedic at one point, so he was going on all these runs. Because it was Kevin's buddies, they started coming over here hanging out. We had to be like, listen, we like you guys, but we really can't have an ambulance just sitting outside the front door. You got to move that. Yeah, so
hide that somewhere.
Don't have an ambulance ready to go. And we don't have injuries very often at all. It's more the injuries happen with us when we're trying to do stupid stuff like backflips to the wall.
Dave is pretty laid back about the whole indoor skydiving thing. A few months ago, he took his 2-year-old daughter into the tunnel for her birthday. His wife didn't object because, well, the white bridal flying suit displayed in the upstairs hallway belongs to her.
Me and my wife got married in the tunnel on October 1st. It's me and my wife met in the tunnel. It's where we, you know, the first time I ever set eyes on her was in the tunnel. And so it just kind of made sense that we kind of seal the deal there too, I guess, right? Did the ceremony in the tunnel and shuttled everybody out real quick, topped it out, and flew up to the top to kiss.
So you weren't trying to say your vows over the roar of the engine?
No, that would be ridiculous.
This is Las Vegas, but most people don't come to Flyaway to get married. Skydivers come to places like this to practice, and people like me, looking for a thrill but not ready for the real thing, come here to try out body flight. Indoor skydiving may be less deadly, less expensive, and less intimidating than jumping out of an airplane, but Dave says that doesn't mean the sport is less difficult.
This is harder. The tunnel is definitely harder. You only have a 12-foot sky. Up there, you can mess up all you want. You're still going to be in the sky. Here, you have to refine your body position. You really have to focus on what you're doing more. Wind tunnel flying is a little different than skydiving because of that reason and because we're pushing air past you. You're not falling through clean air. So you gotta work for it a little bit more, which makes you a better body flyer.
Newer indoor skydiving centers, like the one opening in New Hampshire this summer, try to solve that problem by sucking the air from above the flyer rather than blowing it from below, an innovation they say makes the sport less dangerous and easier to master. Built in the early 80s, Flyaway is old school, which hasn't stopped Flyaway employees like Dave from using almost unlimited flight time to master front and back flips, head-down carves, and tricks of a more exotic nature.
Like I do the shrimp kebab, which is one I got to name because it's my trick, and I can barely do it. I can't even do it, but it's like a shrimp on a kebab. It's two shrimp.
Come on here, guys. Watch your step.
An instructor named Corey leads a group of three snowboarding instructors from Vail, Colorado, into the tunnel for their three-minute flights. The flyers are wearing baggy flight suits designed to capture the air and fill up like balloons. But Corey makes a big production out of wrapping a wide weightlifting belt around his T-shirt and pants.
No, it does not hold me down on the ground, and I don't have a bad back today. What it does do is it keeps my clothes on, and I'm serious about that. It really does keep my clothes on. Good, right, Dave?
Thank you for
wearing
that.
Dave saw me without my shirt on one time. He went home crying to his mom.
It's an easy joke, and one that all the instructors here seem to use to lighten the mood. Corey shuts the tunnel door and pantomimes proper body position. Once the fan gets going, it will be even more important to communicate without words, as the fan makes talking or even shouting impossible. All three of Corey's charges manage to fly, with varying success, staying just a few feet above the net and safety pads. Between each one-minute flight, Corey hops into the airstream to illustrate technique. During the third and final flight, Corey feels confident enough about one flyer that he lifts him above his head and tosses him higher like pizza dough.
That takes, you know, a little technique. Also, depending on the flyer, some people, worst time is if you throw them up there and then they freak out and then they try to, like, fall on you.
Corey's been an instructor for about a year, but before that, he was one of Flyaway's least successful customers.
I was horrible, actually. I was god-awful. But, yeah, I wanted to come back and, you know, like, actually do it. I don't want anybody to touch me. I want to do it on my own. And then after I started to get it, it was, like, addicting. Every time I fly, still today, I learn new stuff in the tunnel every time.
Corey's become so enamored of flying that he's training to become a certified skydiver. At each level, he must perform certain skills in the air to the satisfaction of the instructor he's paid to accompany him. That's when having a nearby wind tunnel comes in handy.
In the sky, the most you get, I have gotten so far, it might have been 55, but that's a long time in the sky. Most tandem jumps are, you know, anywhere from 45 to 50 seconds. Whereas in here, you know, you spend 3 minutes in there, you're flying for a solid 3 minutes. It's a lot of fun.
Come on in, have a seat.
Oh, boy.
When it's my turn to fly, Josh leads me into a classroom to watch a five-minute video, which starts predictably with experienced skydivers performing all sorts of amazing tricks at indoor and outdoor skydiving centers around the world.
Welcome to Flyaway. Right after this tape and a short briefing, you'll be able to taste the thrill of skydiving without ever leaving the ground at America's first indoor skydiving wind tunnel.
The video cheerfully explains proper body position, hand signals, and safety procedures. And then things get serious.
Body flying is lots of fun, but you have to be aware of the risks involved. When your instructor comes back in the classroom, he's going to give you a waiver. This legal document states that you're aware that just like skydiving and other related sports, you could be seriously injured or even killed. It's our policy to give you a full refund if you decide not to fly at this point.
Waiver signed, Josh hands me a huge flying suit to put on over my clothes, goggles to keep my contacts from blowing away, and, at my request, a bright pink helmet.
You're starting to look even more and more ridiculous. Gotta be honest.
I'm more than a little nervous as Josh leads me into the wind tunnel for my flight. The room is padded all around, and the 12-foot flying column is surrounded by thick foam safety pads. Josh has me practice flinging myself onto them. It's not only expected, but guaranteed that I will fall out of the air column a few times during my flight. Then I take position face down on the bouncy net that's suspended above the 12-foot fan. The fan starts slowly at first, buffeting me inches off the net and then back down. From the control room, another instructor slowly increases the power, so I'm lifted up off the net by inches at first, then feet, until finally I'm looking eye to eye with Josh, who's standing upright on the net, pushing and pulling at my arms and legs to get me into correct flying position. It was only 30 seconds of flight, but I'm glad for a rest as Dave jumps into the air, twisting and turning with ease. When it's my turn again, Josh signals me to jump into the airstream as if I'm diving into a pool of water. Somehow, it works, and I find my balance in the column of air. This time, I'm more confident and stable enough that Dave jumps in with me, flipping and spinning while I try to stay out of his way. When my 3 minutes are up, I tuck and roll for a soft landing on the safety pads, uninjured, exhausted, and still giggling.
That was excellent work.
Whoa.
For Only a Game, I'm Karen Given in Las Vegas.
Wow.
It's a rush, huh?
That's a lot of wind. I'm gonna free fall out into nothing. Gonna leave this world for a while.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Ferrati. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287, toll free. CDs and cassettes are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to view Karen Given's indoor skydiving photo gallery, listen to stories past and present, or sign up for our newsletter, please visit onlyagame.org. Our final word comes from Dave McMahon, manager of Flyaway Indoor Skydiving.
I wish we could be open 24 hours. That would be so nice. Wake up at 4 in the morning, I feel like flying. Which I can do, but there's nobody here and it's dark and scary.
Hey, everything else in Vegas is open 24 hours, or so I'm told. Just put a couple of one-armed bandits in the wind tunnel and all will be bright and unscary around the clock. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from WBUR Boston, the Kellogg Foundation, helping people help themselves by investing in individuals, their families, and their communities. WKKF.org. The Pew Charitable Trusts, serving the public interest through information, policy solutions, and support for civic life. PewTrusts.org. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, continuing support of individual creativity with the announcement of new MacArthur Fellows September 20th. This is NPR, National Public Radio.